The reading is from Luke chapter 1, verses 1 to 25, and you'll find that on page 1025 of your pew Bibles. That's page 1025, Luke chapter 1. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. In the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah, who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. His wife Elizabeth was also a descendant of Aaron. Both of them were upright in the sight of God, observing all the Lord's commandments and regulations blamelessly. But they had no children, because Elizabeth was barren, and they were both well along in years. Once, when Zechariah's division was on duty and he was serving as priest before God, he was chosen by lot, according to the custom of the priesthood, to go into the temple and burn incense. And when the time for the burning of incense came, all the assembled worshippers were praying outside. Then an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing at the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was startled and was gripped with fear. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you are to give him the name John. He will be a joy and delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth. For he will be great in the sight of the Lord. He is never to take wine or other fermented drink, and he will be filled with the Holy Spirit even from birth. Many of the people of Israel will he bring back to the Lord their God, and he will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord." Zechariah asked the angel, "How can I be sure of this? I am an old man, and my wife is well along in years." The angel answered, "I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and to tell you this good news. And now you will be silent and not able to speak until the day this happens, because you did not believe my words, which will come true at their proper time." Meanwhile, the people were waiting for Zechariah and wondering why he stayed so long in the temple. When he came out, he could not speak to them. They realized he had seen a vision in the temple, for he kept making signs to them, but remained unable to speak. When his time of service was completed, he returned home. After this, his wife Elizabeth became pregnant, and for 5 months remained in seclusion. "The Lord has done this for me," she said. "In these days, he has shown his favor and taken away my disgrace among the people."
Well, as Patricia mentioned, we're going back to the beginning, as it were. Since the autumn, we've been in Luke's Gospel, haven't we? One of those four historical accounts of Jesus' life. We've been working our way through the sort of life, adult ministry of Jesus, chapters 3 to 5, thinking about those things. But today, with the beginning of Advent, We're going back to the beginning of chapter 1. I realise that's chronologically the wrong way round, but that's how we decided to do it. So this Advent we'll be spending our time in Luke chapters 1 and 2. And this morning we begin to see something of God, how in his infinite wisdom he places the entire weight of his salvation plan on the back of two unborn babies. We may think that's a bit risky, a bit sort of uncertain, but as we'll see, God knows just what he's doing. As Julia was reading it for us, you may have noticed that where Luke begins, he begins in verses 1 to 4 telling us how what he has written is fact, how what we're going to be looking at over these next few weeks is true. These things really happened. That means that 2,000 years ago, had we been alive and living in the right part of the world, we could have witnessed all of this for ourselves. I think when it comes to looking at the Bible, in my experience, broadly speaking, people can fall into one of three categories. Some will say it's fiction. It's just made up stuff. Some might say, well it's not all made up. It's faction. So it's made up stories based on real events. Sure, Jesus lived, but the stories we have about him now have been grown in some fantastical thing. Others will say, no, it's non-fiction. It is fact. They are true stories that really happened. And it's worth us thinking through where we stand on that, particularly at Christmas time, isn't it? It's not always straightforward when we think about the birth of Jesus to separate fact from fiction. So we look at a nativity scene and we think, well, we know Rudolph shouldn't be in it. And we're pretty sure that Father Christmas shouldn't be there either. But we've maybe got the three wise men sat next to the shepherds. Now, we're not actually told, are we, how many wise men there were? There were three gifts. So we assume there were three wise men, but we don't actually know for certain. We can also be pretty sure that they arrived a good long while after the shepherds. So they're probably not in the same scene. But even with our sort of Christian nativity, the lines can get blurred a little bit. But as Luke begins this account, he wants you and I to be certain. Certain that what we read about here actually happened. This isn't a work of fiction. It's not a work of faction. It is indeed true. And that's why he begins by telling us why he's written what he's written and why it's worth you and I reading again this Advent time. He says that he's carefully, not sloppily, investigated everything, not some things, from the beginning, not halfway through. But you and I are not to pay attention just because Luke says, well, I've been really thorough. We're to pay attention because what he's writing about is really significant for each and every one of us. He's saying to his friend Theophilus, the first recipient of this letter, I want you to have absolute confidence in the truth of what I write. Theophilus, I want you to be certain this is what happened and this is how it happened. And Theophilus, I want you to be certain because I'm going to tell you some really amazing things. Miraculous things, almost unbelievable things, things where you'll naturally feel a bit uncertain about it. Theophilus, I want you to be certain. And the care with which Luke has gone about this task means that it's not just Theophilus, but you and I here this morning, we can be absolutely certain that these things took place. And so two things to be certain of this morning. The first one is this: God's promised plan of salvation is underway. God's promised plan of salvation is underway. We're there introduced, aren't we, to an elderly couple in verses 5 to 7. Elderly married couple, Zechariah and Elizabeth. And they are living during the reign of King Herod the Great. He was a man given his position by Rome to keep the peace in Israel during Roman occupation. See, Luke's immediately putting us into a historical context during the reign of King Herod. But what do we learn of Zechariah and Elizabeth? Well, a couple of things. We're told in verse 6 that in God's sight, they are upright. That is to say, they wake up each morning seeking to live God's way. And they've been doing that all their years, even amidst the deep disappointment, verse 7, of not being able to have children. So this couple, Zechariah and Elizabeth, they were known for their righteousness, their seeking to live God's way, and also their childlessness. And so as we're introduced to them, I think Luke's encouraging us to understand something of the sadness of their situation. How at some point they had to adjust to the reality that their could not have children has now become a would not have children. It's a reminder to us that being righteous and blameless, it never means a challenge-free life, exemption from heartache. Being righteous and blameless doesn't mean that every desire of our hearts will be given. Those who serve God, they're not free from pain and suffering. But Elizabeth and Zechariah, they appear to us here in Luke 1 as those who have continued to serve God faithfully through their disappointments. Their hopes fixed on God himself rather than on the hope of what God might or might not give them. And then in verses 8 to 10, we move to Zechariah and his role as a priest. Now, in Jesus' day, it's been calculated there are about 18,000 priests in Israel. And they were divided into 24 groups. And these groups were taken in turns twice a year to spend a week serving at the temple in Jerusalem. And it's the week when Zechariah's division, his group, are on duty that God's plan of salvation is announced. So we see in verse 9, having been selected by lot, Zechariah is to burn incense in the temple. And believe it or not, being selected to burn incense was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. If you're a priest in Israel and your lot was drawn and you got to burn incense that week, you weren't in the pot again. Once you'd done it, you weren't allowed to do it again. So Zechariah's being chosen to burn incense is actually a really big deal. You could argue in his priestly career, well, it's the pinnacle. Sports people often speak, don't they, of how it's a great honour to captain their country. Well, for a priest in Jerusalem, it's a great honour if you get to burn incense in the temple. I imagine Zechariah probably had a difficult night's sleep the night before as he went over and over in his head what he had to do and when he had to do it. Have I got the matches? Check. Have I got my safety spectacles? Check. Have I got my incense? Check. Okay, we're good to go. So there he is. He's going thinking, wow, this is it. It's a big deal, him going to the temple. But obviously, we read it, when he arrives, he gets a lot more than he was expecting. Do look down with me at verse 11. Let me read that again. He's in the temple. Then an angel of the Lord appeared to Zechariah, standing at the right side of the altar of incense. So there's Zechariah concentrating on lighting his incense when an angel of the Lord appears. And he appears to give him a message straight from God, which is what angels do in the Bible, isn't it? The word actually just means messenger in Greek. And if you flick on to verse 19, the angel Gabriel himself explains what he does. I've been sent to speak good news. I'm a messenger. But Zechariah's original response in verse 12 isn't this is good news, is it? It's one of fear, we're told. Which is why the first bit of the message in verse 13 is, do not be afraid. God has sent his messenger to Zechariah, but it's a message of good news. He's not to be afraid. Now, we'll think more about what is said in just a moment, but first we have to understand the significance of this. You may be sat there thinking, well, it's Advent. Surely we're going to focus on Jesus. We don't get to Jesus today, believe it or not. But what is going on here is really, really very significant. Now, at one level, obviously, a messenger of God appearing to anyone at any time is significant. But how much more so after 400 years of silence from God? You see, between the book of Malachi, that's the last book in the Old Testament, and the Gospels, the four historical accounts of Jesus' life, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in the New Testament, there's been a gap of 400 years. So if you flip back to Malachi, you'd have Malachi, then you'd have a single page, then you'd have Matthew. That single page, which might say New Testament on it, it represents 400 years of silence from God. And that would have been deeply unnerving for God's people. You see, way back at the beginning of the Old Testament, in Genesis, begins with God speaking. And he speaks the world into creation. But God isn't just then like the giant watchmaker who winds up the clock and then leaves it ticking. As we go through the Old Testament, we see how God continues to interact with his world, to communicate with the people he made. And God either does that directly, speaking to them, as he does with Moses, for example, or God does it indirectly through angels, messengers, but also through humans. They're called prophets. They're like prophets like Malachi, the last book of the Old Testament, where God would give them the message and then they would tell it to the people. That's how a prophet works in the Old Testament. They receive the message from God and then they deliver it to the people. Just like Gabriel here, he's been sent with a message from God that he delivers to Zechariah. And that message in the Old Testament would often involve God encouraging people to turn back to him. They've wandered away from him like sheep, and he says, come on back, come on back. I love you, come on back. But after the events recorded in Malachi, about 400 BC, silence from God. Now, we all know relationally how that works, doesn't it? If you've got a friend or a spouse or a relative who just stops speaking to you, say it's 4 years rather than 400 years, it's hard to take that positively, isn't it? It's usually a sign that they want nothing to do with you. And so after 400 years, the people of Israel in Jesus' day, they're thinking, well, maybe God really has given up on us this time. My father and mother didn't hear anything from God. Their parents didn't hear anything from God. Their parents didn't hear anything. Or their great-great-grandparents didn't hear anything from God. He's been silent for 400 years. Maybe this time God really has given up on us. Maybe it really is the silent treatment from here on in. Nothing for 400 years until now. With Zechariah, he goes thinking he's lighting some incense. He receives a message from the Lord. And what God is now saying is that his great plan of salvation is about to begin. The promise of the Old Testament is now coming true. And it begins with a baby. A baby who we read in verse 13 will be called John, whose parents are the elderly, childless Elizabeth and Zechariah. Now, there's no doubt that when John is born, he'll be special in the eyes of his parents. Of course he will. He'll be much loved, having been so longed for. That's why we read in verse 14, he'll be a joy and a delight to Zechariah and Elizabeth. But as the verse continues, we're told that many others will rejoice because of his birth as well. That's not just talking about the wider family and all Zechariah's mates down at the bowling club. What's that meaning is good news, rejoicing for many worldwide, ultimately. You see, God's salvation plan, the Old Testament doesn't all point forwards to an elderly, childless couple having a baby called John. That's just the beginning of God's plan. And as we see here, the focus is really on what this child, John, will do. He's the first step in God's plan being put into action. So what the angel Gabriel reveals to us in verses 15 to 17 is that John is in effect going to be another prophet. He's going to be in the same mold as Elijah, one of the most famous prophets from the Old Testament. He's going to be God's messenger, this child, John. He's going to call people to turn around, to turn back to God, having turned away. As we were thinking earlier, God created our world just by speaking. But since the creation of the world, everyone has turned from him and gone their own way. They've ignored, disobeyed what God says. Now, as a result of that, two relationships are affected, aren't they? Both the relationship with God, that vertical relationship, we're ignoring him, leave me alone, I'd rather do my own thing. But actually, we read in the Bible that actually our relationships with one another are affected as well. And that's why as we approach Christmas each year, we have this sort of, this challenge, don't we? On the one hand, we want to celebrate and be joyful, and we do. But we also look at our world and see the brokenness. Well, that's ever since we've turned from God. It affects our relationship with him and our relationships with one another. But what John is going to do, here's the good news. Verse 17, John is the beginning of God going about restoring those relationships. Both our relationships with each other, the hearts of fathers will be turned back to children. But also our relationship with God, the disobedient will be turned and made righteous. That is, those who are unright with God for turning from him will be turned and made right with God. That's God's salvation plan. It's crucial that we don't miss that God is picking up where he left off. See, the last words of God recorded in Malachi are repeated here in verse 17 of Luke chapter 1. See, God hasn't given up on them. He hasn't abandoned them. He was just waiting. Now, we're not told, are we, at this point in Luke, the means by which God will do all this. That'll be the message that John brings. We haven't yet been given the means, but we do know that God is acting. The wheels are beginning to turn on his global salvation plan. It's the first thing we can be certain of. It wasn't just a celebrating any old birth that we read of in Luke 1. The second point is this: God's plan of salvation is unstoppable. God's plan of salvation is unstoppable. I wonder if, as it was read for us, you sort of felt a little bit sorry for Zechariah, maybe a little bit of sympathy for him. He's already having quite an emotional day, isn't he? But by the end of it, he's left speechless. On the biggest day of his career, he's told that his elderly wife, who is barren, is going to give birth to their first child. And so we can understand his question there in verse 18. He asks the angel, how can I be sure of this? How can I be certain? Now, if at first glance it looks like he just needs a bit of clarification, in verse 20 we see it's not that. We see in verse 20, you will be silent and not able to speak until the day this happens. Why? Because you did not believe my words. And remember, Angel Gabriel is a messenger from God. The angel doesn't speak his own words. He speaks God's. So actually what's going on in Zechariah is unbelief. It's not just any old Tom, Dick or Harry who's turned up to have a chat with him. It's the angel Gabriel sent from God himself to give him good news. And Zechariah doesn't believe it. He's not certain. Seems that for Zechariah, the thought of God being able to give them a child at their age is just frankly unbelievable. He wants more proof. The promise of God is not enough for him. Yes, he prayed and he's asked God for a child in the past, but now, well, they're just both so old. So for Elizabeth to become pregnant now, well, that would be miraculous. And Zechariah is not sure God can do it. Now, we mustn't lose sight. He is upright in God's sight. He's a good, morally upright, believing Jew. He believes in God. But he doesn't believe God can do this. It's as if God is acting in a way that Zechariah cannot possibly get his head around. Doesn't fit into the box in which he's put God. It's God acting beyond Zechariah's expectations. So it's good to stop and ask ourselves the question, isn't it? What sort of God do we believe in? Have we placed limits on what God can do? Do we believe what Luke has carefully investigated and recorded for us? Are we certain God can do what we read of here? Because if we're struggling to get our head round a God who can give a child to an elderly couple, we'll wait till we get to Mary. See, it may seem impossible, humanly speaking, but it's not a human speaking, is it? It's God's. It's his message, his words, his miracle. Now, we still might feel some sympathy towards Zechariah. After all, we can probably all relate to doubting God's promises ourselves. If we've been a Christian believer for any length of time, we will know something of what it is to doubt God's promises. Of course, it's only the Christian believer who doubts God's promises. The unbeliever doesn't believe the promise in the first place, let alone doubt it. We will all face doubts. But one of the causes, it seems, is when we focus on our problems more than God's promises. Zechariah focuses more on the fact that he's old, as is his wife, and she's never given birth before. So he receives a promise, but he struggles to believe it. You know how we can block out the sun with a 50p piece? I meant to bring a 50p piece with me and I forgot. But if you hold a 50p close enough to your eye, it'll block out the sun, won't it? Now, is the 50p bigger than the sun? No, of course it's not. It's just a matter of perspective. But if I focus too much on the 50p, I can't even see the sun behind. It's the same when we focus too much on our own problems. We can lose sight of God's promises and power. Zechariah, it seems, he's focusing on the problems with what God has said rather than the person who has said it. He wants more proof. God's promise wasn't enough. And when we lose our perspective, it's possible for us to pray. It's possible for us to sing praise. It's possible to preach, all the while not really believing God's promises. Zechariah, remember, he was a good and godly man, verse 6. He was a good and godly man who had doubts, like we all do. Well, let's not make the same mistake. Let's learn from Zechariah, learn to not lose sight of God's promises. We don't just need to learn from him, we get to rejoice with him because we see also God's patience and grace towards him. See, despite his doubts, Zechariah is not dismissed, is he? The message doesn't read, oh, well, if you're not going to believe me, I'll find someone who does. No, no. Zechariah is graciously given the chance to look and listen and learn. The angel says to Zechariah, in fact, look, just shush for a while and watch God at work. Zechariah must listen to God to learn his lesson. God will bring his promises to pass, just like he always does. See, what God promises, he will perform. Only he will do it in his time. And he will do it sometimes in surprising ways. We may wish sometimes that we could tell God how to make his plans and when to do them. But we need to trust that God's timing is always the best timing. That the creator of the universe knows actually what he is doing. Well, does Zechariah learn his lesson? Well, we'll hopefully think more about that in a few weeks' time when we get there. But in short, the answer is yes, he does. Because 9 months later, just as God promised, Elizabeth does get pregnant, she does give birth. And when Zechariah says, no, he really must be called John, that's the first time he gets to speak. And part of me thinks, wow, he had to wait 9 months. That was quite a long time. But the more I think about it, I think Zechariah was quite a quick learner compared to me. I've been trying to learn the same lesson for years and years and years. Make sure my focus is on God's promise, not my problems. So I think actually, credit where credit's due, Zechariah is rather quick. But as I finish, we mustn't miss the bigger picture here as well. God's plans, they're not dependent on Zechariah comprehending, agreeing, or even believing, are they? This isn't God speculating. This is God saying that what I've started, I will finish. So often our plans are conditional. Conditional on ourselves, conditional on others. I guess in the past week or two, we've all had to change our plans because someone hasn't been well. Conditional on things that are completely out of our control. How many football matches were cancelled yesterday because of the weather? But when it comes to God's salvation plan, it's not conditional on anyone else, and that's really good news. It depends on him. Which is why it is unstoppable. It's a really good thing. It's a really good thing, of course, for Elizabeth. She does become pregnant, and we read how she praises God for the favor he's shown her. She's a great example to us, isn't she? Despite personal disappointments, she continues to serve God. And when God does grant the desires of her heart, she doesn't forget to say thank you. She doesn't forget to remember who it is who's given her this child. Even when her sadness is reversed, even when her disappointment is turned to joy, she doesn't forget God's. She doesn't get caught up in her good circumstances. She rejoices in what God has done for her, in his favour towards her. So we see that, yep, God's plan is unstoppable. That's a good thing for Elizabeth. It's a good thing for you and I as well. Because just as Luke intends, we can be certain. Certain not only that these things happened, but certain that with these things happening, God has set in motion his salvation plan. Which means that our hearts can be turned back to him. Our relationship with him can be restored. Let's have a moment's quiet, and then I'll lead us in a prayer.